So Dave, we actually have a sponsor this week. Who is it?
The Manhattan Project Energy Empire.
Dave, how would you describe the Manhattan Project Energy Empire?
Brotto Runs Through's number one engine builder of all time.
What is it you do in the Manhattan Project Energy Empire?
Harness the Earth's resources.
Is it a good game?
An instant classic for worker placement games, says Man vs. Meeple.
Tell us more about how you play.
Develop your economy. Manage your environmental impact.
This must be an award-winning game, right?
The Dice Tower's number three game of 2016.
Cool. Where can I buy myself a copy?
On sale now at retailers everywhere. Hello, nerds. Welcome back to the Dice Section. We have the regular crew here. I'm Dave Kirby, and we also have Michael Harrison.
Flying high on muscle relaxers.
As we determined earlier today, this will be peak Michael.
Woo!
Also, Jeff Baroknik.
That's me. I am not on anything.
Well, I mean, we're on life. I had some Jack Daniels earlier also, so I'm on that.
Yeah, well, I'm married with kids. I have none of that stuff.
You could have Jack Daniels, right?
I could.
Don't you guys have Jack? Don't you have Jack Daniels on a regular basis around the house?
It's pretty important. I'd say
there is a bottle in the there is a bottle in the room. Do I need to remedy this?
I mean, no, we're okay. We're fine. So we're here to answer before we get to discussing our game of the week or. Yeah, of the week, right? It's of the week. Our game of the week is Stone Age, which is an awesome worker placement game that we, I think, all very much enjoy. But first we have to ask the question, since I, you know, to some degree messed up Jeff's copy of Castles of Mad King Ludwig, the question is, how messed up does your copy of a board game have to be before you're done playing it? I think we all come in on at like different levels here, right? So, Jeff, tell me first, since I messed up your game, how much do you care that basically like one piece is no longer usable?
I played with it two nights ago. Had a fun time, even though like I saw when that piece was coming up, knew exactly what it was, and I just flipped it over so that Chuck would know.
So, like, you just say, okay, this is now a modded game where we all know where this particular piece is in the face-down stack. We both know what it is.
Well, I don't want to take any sort of unfair advantage. I could just take that piece out and throw it away. I think that the game will play just as fine. Again, like, you know, if half of the pieces were ruined, that would be a totally different thing. But I think that
Let's say it's a downstairs room, right? Just, I don't even know which piece it is, but let's say it's a downstairs room in Castles, and suddenly, if you remove that from the game, now pursuing downstairs rooms is, like, not as viable a strategy. Maybe I'm, like, too OCD about it, but I feel like that ruins the game, and it can never be played again, and it must be replaced with an entirely new $60 copy of whatever it was, right? I don't know. Maybe I'm nuts. What do you think, Michael?
I think this is why we need, like a flea market for games pieces. You know, just an exchange where you can go in and kind of say, you know what, because let's say Jeff did decide, okay, my game is screwed up enough to where I'm going to buy a new copy of it. What's he going to do with all those other pieces?
There needs to be
on the flea market
a board game chop shop where you can take it in and like scratch the BGIN off of every single piece and just sell it on the street.
So I will actually say that I had a copy of Acquire that I played all through my childhood. Like, this is one of my dad's favorite board games. Acquire is a hotel chain building game that came out in the 70s, I think. And it was my game, and so therefore at some point or other, you know, like in some move, it lost one piece. And Acquire is not a game that you can play at all missing a piece. Castles of Mad King Ludwig, if you're playing with less than four players, you take out some random numbers of the rooms in stacks, so the game could naturally play without downstairs rooms anyways.
Oh, I forgot about that. So you can just say that that's always one of the ones that comes out. Okay.
Right. Unless you're playing with four players. But with a choir, it's there's like this grid, and every single tile needs to be available on this grid. So for that game, I did go out to buy a second copy of it just in order to get like this one token. And the second copy I acquired had spare pieces in it. So if either of you guys would like to play a hotel chain building, would like to own a hotel chain building game from the 70s, or I will just give this thing away. I got nothing to do with it.
Acquire, that's a Sid Saxon classic, if I recall correctly, right?
So it is.
All right, yeah.
Board game designer name drop. Check. Yeah, not even 5 minutes in.
We should play that for one of the episodes.
That'd oh, let's fun. Do it. Yeah.
So my question:
get a bunch of people and run two games at the same time.
Yeah. My question to you, Jeff, is like there was a certain amount of dancing around the subject when the ruination of the board game occurred. How do you feel as the person whose board game was ruined? Like, yeah, you were definitely playing it cool, telling Dave, you know, you don't need to replace it, whatever. Was that because Dave immediately said, "I will replace it," that you were like, "Oh, that's fine"? If he had just been like, "No big deal, I'm not replacing," like, if it wasn't even up in the air, how would you have reacted?
Oh, I would have been, I would like to think that I would have been just as cool, but I would have been completely pissed off and might not have invited Dave back over to my house again if he hadn't at least apologized. Like, he didn't have to make the offer of replacing it, but once he made that offer, and then we worked out that because you own a copy and we play board games, like, the three of us play board games 90% of the time that we play board games together, at least two out of the three of us, became irrelevant to replace that, and instead I got a copy of one of my favorite games I've ever played. So I came out.
Yeah. I mean, let's be clear. I think I spelled this out last month too, but I mean last week. It was a total Dave move, right? Like, I spend my entire life just like a hair's breadth away from blanking up at all times, like in every situation, right? So knocking over a can of beer onto your copy of Castles, just like super typical Dave. If anything, going like a whole decade without ruining someone's board game was really out of character for me. So, I just sort of always assume I need to like set aside the petty cash to replace other people's belongings, you know? So it's not it's not really crazy for me to just leave your house planning on being $50 or $60 poorer, so that like,
so yeah, we're announcing our you know first tier for our Patreon, where everybody gets to put in a little bit of money, so that the next time Dave steals something, you
know. he doesn't have to not have electricity for that month.
So I guess like the answer to the question is then it's just game to game, right? Like, I didn't really ruin that copy of Castles. We keep using that word, but it's still usable. Whereas, you know, you're saying Acquire is an example of something you could never play with anything missing at all.
Well, I mean, you could play with some of the hotel. I mean, there are some things you could play with it missing. I mean, it's got you know, Monopoly money, Acquire money, I guess, that you could replace with Monopoly money. It's got some components, but there are games where if it's missing a component, you can't play it. If you've got a copy of the Mousetrap and you're missing the little guy that flips off of the board into the thing,
like everybody is.
Like everybody is. You can't play Mousetrap, but that's okay because it's a horrible game.
Right.
It's a fun toy. It's a horrible game.
This got me once when I backed into someone's car, a coworker from several years ago, and this tiny little, like, the size of a quarter, of an American quarter dollar, like little smidge of paint, got chipped off of a bumper, and I said, "Hey, I will totally replace this," and he was like, "Okay, fine, cool." And then I found out a week later that his plan was to get the entire bumper recoated at like a professional paint shop, and I was on the hook for $480 worth of replacement. And I thought, you know, I can't let this change the way that I feel about immediately owning up to my mistakes, but boy did it test me for a couple minutes there when I when I found like the sum total of what I was being bilked for because there were definitely like $10 or $20 solutions to that problem.
Yep.
Yeah.
And to this day, you can go walk out to my car right now from my apartment and see the tiny little spot of paint missing on my back bumper that I could not give any less of a crap about. Right? Who cares? Meanwhile, like your board game that is this functional thing that is, you know, debatably less functional or non-functional at all. I'm like, no, it's totally my responsibility to fix that if you think it is. I don't know.
I think the etiquette is if you have a drink or any other form of potential disaster like sitting around a board game that isn't yours, you're just agreeing to an unwritten contract that if you are the one who knocks something over, you own up and you offer to replace it. That's it.
Agree.
It's that simple. And then if the person who owns the game, like in this case, Jeff, if they say that's fine, no big deal, or, you know, just buy a different game for us, then you're the one who's on the hook to do something.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Okay. All right. Well, I mean, like I said, the minute it happened, I'm like, okay, well, I did that. I haven't done something like that in a long time, but I did. So here we go. Anyway. Well, what we now have is a copy of Stone Age, which is in Jeff's possession, thankfully, because holy smokes, I love this game, right? Michael, are you on board too?
I like it.
Okay, well, we'll get into it. I think you're implying something, which is that Jeff is insanely good at this game compared to the two of us, right?
But we're going to get into that later.
Yeah, we'll get into that. Jeff, why don't you tell us about this game, which you first encountered in Kabul, right?
Yeah, so I actually I was taught how to play this game by some of the Belgian gate guards at the airport in Kabul, Afghanistan, and like there's a surprising amount of board game nerds amongst European European soldiers. And I learned how to play tons of games with these guys, but this was one of the games that just stuck in my mind. The game was designed by Bernd Brunhofer. Although if you're going to buy this game and you see a game called Stone Age designed by Michael Tummerhofer, that's the same game. I guess that was just his nom de game.
Tummelhofer is the Richard Bachman, right?
Yes.
Belthofer is Stephen King. Okay.
Right. Exactly. In any event, right now the most current copies that are being produced, and the designer, according to Board Game Beep, is Bernd Brunhofer. Artist, the art for this game and the art for this game, I think, is magnificent.
Yes.
Michael Menzel, and it's published right now by Z-Man Games.
Excellent depictions of giant bars of gold.
Yeah, we can definitely get into the quality of components. This is a $60 board game, and the component quality is. I feel as good as you're going to get for, you know, a $60 board game.
Agree.
Yeah, for a Euro game, for a game that doesn't have miniatures.
Right. It's got you know, wooden dice and a leather dice cup that you don't need to have, but if you've got it, it's really fun to roll the dice in this primitively stitched leather dice cup, and the art on everything is just so great. Oh yeah, and also has the little standee for the Big Chief as the first player token.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good stuff. So, I'm gonna roll some dice right now in that leather dice cup. Yeah,
I do too. At some point, if one of us is going on for a while, Jeff, you should get the cup and rattle it around in front of your microphone. Or maybe we'll sneak it in at the end of the recording, because it's really satisfying.
Part of me just wants to buy this game so I have that leather cup and I can use it for all my other games.
Well, it's a $60 game that currently goes for like $85 or $90 because they haven't printed it enough recently, apparently, so... So don't spill beer on anyone else's copy of Castles of Mad-Kingland.
And if you have a copy of Castles of Mad-King Ludwig, remember, if some guy spills beer on it, you can still kind of play it if they only ruin a piece or two.
So the explanation of how this game plays is probably pretty simple, right, Jeff? You want to take a shot at it?
Yeah, sure. So it's a worker placement game, and each person starts off with a Stone Age tribe of five workers, and there are several different places. Each round, you'll place your workers in order to first build up an engine. And to collect resources, which you're then using to purchase these scoring cards. So, in order to build your engine, as I said, there's a little village right in the middle of the map, and you can place workers there in order to get tools, increase your agriculture level, or to go to the Hut of Love. It's a. If you want to get an additional worker, this is a common thing for worker placement. The where you might want to get an additional worker. It's the lieutenant, I think, in Lords of Waterdeep.
Yeah.
Well, children, when two meeples meet and fall in love,
then... yes. In this game, you put two meeples down for one move. They go to the Hut of Love. No one else can go there, and then they come out, and there are three meeples because. Yeah. I'll explain this one to your children.
It's a very kinesthetic experience of meeple reproduction as the person placing them there.
So there are also five resource gathering spaces. Spaces that are for wood, brick, stone, and gold, and one for food. And the wood, brick, stone, and gold you use in order to purchase the various things at the in the scoring portion of the game. While the food, you need to have enough food at the end of each round in order to feed your people. So if you try to make a whole bunch of people going to the Hut of Love every single turn, you're eventually going to run out of food, and you're going to be using all those guys to go back to the food space to hunt for more food.
Or not.
Or you could play the starvation game, which I guess was not too terrible for you, Michael, when you tried that with...
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Okay. So, then there's the... there's the scoring mechanisms, and there's two different ways that you can score points in this game. One is by building huts for your little Stone Age tribe to live in, and these huts there's a stack of huts for each player. So if there's three players, there's three stacks of huts. If there's four players, four stacks. Two players, two stacks. And each stack of huts has got, or each card in a stack of huts tells you exactly what you need in order to build this particular hut. So it might be a hut that requires two logs and one brick, which you've gotten from the resource spaces earlier in the game, and that will score you significantly less than a hut that requires two stone and one gold, because those are more difficult resources to gather. Each one of those will score you points immediately, and then you get the hut to sit in your scoring zone for, which may be counted at the end of the game additionally for these civilization cards. And the civilization cards are, this is kind of a tough concept to get across, but you can purchase these cards, which will give you both an immediate benefit. They might give you five food immediately, or one stone, or they may give just three victory points immediately. And they also have an end-of-game scoring effect, which will let you count up the number of people in your tribe, for instance, or the number of huts that you've built over the course of the game, and you get a bonus multiplier for that. Now, when I referred to going to the resource gathering spaces, food, and then the four other resources of wood, brick, stone, and gold, there's a really fun way... I think that this is one of the strengths of the game, and I don't know if you guys are going to agree with me on this, but it's semi-randomized, where if you take two people and you send them off to go log wood in the forest, for instance, you'll at the end of the turn when you're going to utilize them, many worker placement games might say, if you've got a person in the forest, you get one wood for him or two wood for him. In this game, you pick up two dice, six-sided dice, you roll them with your little leather cup, and then you count up the number of pips on the dice, and for wood, you divide by three. For brick, divide by four. Stone, divide by five. Gold, divide by six. Food, divide by two. So if you roll a 12 with your two little dudes sitting there in the forest, you'll get 4 wood, while someone else who might be really unlucky and stuck 4 guys there on the forest might roll a 4 on 4 dice, and he gets 1 piece of wood. And that guy's name is probably Michael.
I love this because I love like mathy stuff in games like this, and I love randomness that I feel like my skill can help control for. So, like, really living on the edge in this game, you're just taking a bunch of very calculated risks. How thin can you spread your tribe? How thin can you spread your workers around the board and still be, like, pretty sure that you're going to generate enough resources to do what you want to do at the end of the turn? Because you're not just placing your workers on the resource generation spots. You also have to place them on the huts or the civilization cards that you want to build or buy. And then sometimes in the same turn, to really get something tricky done, you're saying, okay, I absolutely have to end up with 3 wood to be able to buy this hut that I don't have the wood for and this card that's going to cost me 2 of any resource that I don't have the resources for. So when I go and place my guys on the forest eventually, like, how confident am I? You know, how much am I willing to risk? Do I go crazy and say I'm going to put all the rest of my guys here because I absolutely have to get it? Or am I going to be braver and put my guys other places and try to get even more done?
I find, too, that if you're playing the safe bets and you're putting down a good number of villagers just to mitigate the probabilities, then there's still a good chance that the player who's risking, like, the low probabilities, putting down too few guys, spreading his guys too thin, if he rolls better, you know, if he just has better luck, you know, there's sort of a luck mitigation there that's really strong in this game.
Well, and also, like I was talking about for engine generation, so there's the love hut in the center, which I talked about. There's an agriculture, a farm, which will give you, which will increase your agriculture level, which is separately tracked, and that just gives you free food, like 1 free food for every time that you go to the farm over the course of the game. And then there's also the toolmaker's hut, and the toolmaker's hut allows you to adjust the pips on a die by 1 for every time that you go to the toolmaker's hut. So at the end of the game, you might be able to adjust, you know, like 4 or 5 pips of dice over the course of your rolls, which really helps mitigate that.
And if you love the math part, like I was saying, about approaching the risk in this random resource generation and trying to mitigate the risk, I mean, you're mitigating it with your wrist, unless you're using that dice cup, then it's a whole arm motion. The tools really make it useful. Like, okay, when I go and roll for wood at the end of this turn, and I have 2 tools, that means I have like a 1/3 chance, you know, to bump up above the resource threshold. Like, 6 gives me 2 wood, but with the 2 tools that allow me to add 2 to this pip total at the end of the roll, getting to 7 means I can bump up to 9 with those 2 tools, and now I have 3 wood. So it's like another fun little mathy thing to work out in your head before you make your decisions each turn.
Yeah, and that risk mitigation is honestly the thing that changes this game from Role Player that we were talking about last month week, because it feels like you've got 2 avenues of constant mitigation for what happens when you roll a die. In this game, you can either use a tool to change it, or you can just roll another die by throwing another dude onto the space. And that was something that I realized that my love of this game and my concerns about dice rolling for Role Player are a little bit incongruous, and that's the only thing that I can say to explain that.
I think the last thing we're missing here, forgive me if I didn't just give you time to get to it, but the reason you only ever mentioned rolling up to 7 dice to generate resources is that all the resource spots have exactly 7 spots and no more, right? So even in a maximum player game, like a 4-player game, only 7 dice could ever be rolled to represent workers in the forest or in the quarry or whatever, like rolling for wood or what's the quarry? Is that for stone?
Yeah. Quarry stone, yeah. Clay pits for brick and the river is panning for gold.
And then as you reduce the number of players, you also have the fact where Like, in a three-player game, only two of the players can place their workers on any given resource generation spot. So once Michael puts even one worker into the forest, and Jeff puts even one worker into the forest, I, as the third player, I just can't go to the forest anymore. And then when you get to a head-to-head game, you can block off the other, your one opponent, by being the one person to place something in the forest. So there's a whole lot of, like, denying someone based on, you know, your options. And it can be really easy to deny someone, especially in a head-to-head game.
Oh, yeah. And that's, I mean, it's not entirely take that, but it does feel pretty good when you actually, in a three-player game, when you're working with one guy just to dick that third guy over there who thought that he was being so clever.
Like, they won't notice that I just placed my worker on a hut that requires gold that will win me the game, but I don't have the gold for. You just, like, maybe they won't notice that I did that.
Right.
Never happens, at least with this group. One of the things that I love is the engine building aspect of it, and how, you know, the same sort of rules apply to the village. I think in the three-player game, only two of the village slots can be occupied, so... You know, if you're not the first two people who place your meeple down there, you're not going to get, you know, an extra guy, or you're not going to get a tool, or you're not going to get agriculture, and I think that kind of, like, maybe for me the best strategy would be to have a sort of an even development of all of those three things. You know, you have a couple of tools, you have a few extra meeples to distribute across the board, and you have enough agriculture to where you're not constantly fighting to feed your guys at the end of each round. But it's really hard to do that when, you know, half of the time you're not going to be able to place your guys there.
It's bizarre, though. Like, we should make this clear, though. We said we were going to get to it at some point. Let's just get to it now. At least let's make it clear. We have never beat Jeff at this game. We're close to a dozen plays that involved Jeff in some fashion, whether it be three players, four players, or head-to-head. None of us have ever beat Jeff. He has won every single game that we have played against him. And I think...
Yeah, it's absurd.
What we're missing is that... this balance between engine building and scoring, whether it be scoring right now on a hut or a civilization card that has points attached to it, or planning long term by buying a civilization card with an end game scoring multiplier, right? Somehow we are always striking the wrong balance, and Jeff is surgically striking at the cards or huts that are worth it right now, or worth it in the long run. And then at the end of every game, we find out, God, he beat us by 30 points again out of 200 or whatever. So I love building engines in engine building games, but the first six times, I think, I came in last, no matter who was in the game, because I was going crazy getting agriculture and, like, mating and stuff.
It's very important to build your engine at the start of the game and then to let that engine go forward. I don't even know if I can actually explain... No, I do know that I cannot actually explain what it is that I'm doing in order to outscore you guys by 30 or 40 points in a game, other than I just have like a feeling for, oh, well, now we're coming around the corner into the mid game or towards the end game, and so now I just need to put the gas on for picking up all of the bonus end of game scoring tool cards, because I've got four tools and I can probably make it six tools by the end of the game. No idea how to explain how that is. It's a feeling that I get, and maybe I don't know. Is that the reason that I like this game so much? Is because I've just managed to figure out that balance there.
Yeah, it's not even luck either, because I wouldn't say that you haven't been terribly lucky in any of the games that we've been playing. Boggles my mind.
Well, you're rolling, you roll so many dice that, you know, like, in every single game, everyone is going to, you know, roll three dice and get an 18 on it, and the next guy is going to roll six dice and get, you know, a 9 on them. Like,
I know. Consistently, you are doing better than us. It means that you are consistently playing better than us. And, yep, we're Still trying to figure that out.
I love this, that the skill ceiling is so high. That's something I love about this game. I feel like I've gotten better every time, whether my results have shown it or not.
Oh, no, they have, for sure. I mean, we've come closer and closer every single time.
Right. And definitely it feels more and more like you guys are picking up on. I mean, the first few games I wasn't even particularly trying, because I had played this game probably 10 or 15 times before I played it with you guys. The first few times you guys just weren't recognizing, you know, some of these civilization cards were really, really great cards. Now you guys know that when, like, the little three hut thing comes up.
Oh, trips huts. I hate it. You always get trips huts.
Doesn't matter how much it costs. It doesn't matter if you've got to pay it with stone. You buy that trips huts immediately, because that will win you the game practically by itself.
It is wild. Like, what I didn't understand the first couple times were, why Jeff was ignoring the agriculture spot at the beginning of the game. And then now, on like turn 7 or 8, he's suddenly placing on agriculture every time. That doesn't make any sense. Why does he care? And I just wasn't recognizing, oh, you have now like 3 or 4 times multiplier for score at the end of the game based on your agriculture level. So getting your agriculture up every turn, not only is it generating you free food, it's also just scoring you points. So like the value of that action has increased over the game every time you've bought a card that increases that score. It's like, it's just so hard to keep all those like gears interlocked in your mind. I really do still have trouble with it.
Well, in that very last head-to-head game that we played, there on the second to last turn, I picked up 2 double tool multipliers, in a single turn, which, you know, like, I think I had 5 tools or something like that, so multiply by 4, that was 20 points right there just from 2 cards.
I hadn't done the math, but I had a feeling that I was letting you run away with the game as I was trying to end it right there, rather than blocking you off. But I also felt like using my actions to block you off from, like, one obvious route of scoring would just steer you in another direction of scoring. So, like, I didn't know what to do in that game.
Yeah, I was trying to end the game in that game, because I just figured we were at a point where if I just grabbed all the rest of the huts in one stack. That, by the way, I didn't mention this. The end of the game comes when you deplete one of the hut stacks, or when you deplete all the civilization cards. So one of the two scoring methods becomes empty, then the game is over.
And so on average, right, like you're probably playing a 10 to 15 turn game. Maybe 15 at the very, like, longest. Doesn't that sound about right?
Yeah, probably. With a 3-player game. I think that you actually end up getting more rounds with more players. So this is a game that I think if you're playing with 2 people, you can probably hack this game out in between half an hour and 45 minutes. And you're playing a 4-player game, you'd better settle in for an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah, I'd say 90 minutes minimum, unless you're just not talking at all.
One of the things that you just made me think of with the last round of the game, or the last few rounds, is how you have to start making those decisions between, am I going to take these, you know, these 2 multiplier tools cards simply because it's going to give Jeff too many points, even if it's only going to give me a few? You know, I find that to be kind of a very dissatisfying thing at the end of a game, when I'm purposefully doing things to prevent someone from getting net points on me. It just feels less. It doesn't feel as much of a like as much of an accomplishment, right?
And it certainly isn't when you're playing, you know, in a 3 or 4 player game. Now, you and I haven't played a 1-on-1 game, Mike? But did you feel that way when you're? This is the problem with the games you love, guys. Yeah. Like, if you get good at them, then you can't play them with your friends,
right?
Or you can't play them with your friends who don't already play them.
And the one head-to-head game that I did play, I played with Dave, and I tried a really different strategy.
Oh yeah, that's the very last game mechanic, is that if you run out of food and you can't feed your tribe, you actually just lose 10 points and your food goes to 0, and that's it. Oh, also, you can substitute other resources for food each round. Like, if you're 1 food short, you can use one of any resource for food to feed your tribe. I think the idea you said, Jeff, is that you would go to the market and trade your wood or your stone. But I just like the idea that someone had this, like, golden idol, and they're just chewing on it.
whatever it takes to take the hunger pangs away.
So you told us there's the starvation strategy, right? Isn't that what you called it, Jeff? Where you just you never feed, ever. You just accept that you're going to lose 10 points every round, but you use your, like, your freedom from having to use any of your, like, actions to generate food. You try to use that to generate so many more points than your opponents that you overcome a 10-point loss every single round.
Yeah, I wasn't even aware that this was like a... I mean, I guess I figured it out that it was a thing, but I just decided to try it because I realized you don't... You know, you don't lose anything. Aside from the points, you don't lose your guys. So if you're out there just, you know, mating like crazy, getting tons and tons of extra meeples... then I thought that I'd be able to somehow overcome that negative 10 per round, but I wasn't able to do it. But I guess it is a viable strategy that some people do use to great success.
Yeah, I definitely got my clock cleaned by some... he wasn't a Belgian. I think it was a Danish guy who did that in two or three games. Just never put anything in agriculture, never sent a guy to the farms. And you can definitely when you're trying to feed people, you'll use three or four guys every other round, say. And those guys can make you a ton of points if you're using them in the rest of the game. You do have to end the game pretty quickly, though, because every single turn...
Yep.
You're just losing points, and it becomes pretty difficult to continue to make them up.
So you need to deplete a hut stack exactly at the moment where your opponent was going to turn the corner and use their superior engine to outpace you, right?
Well, their superior engine is just they're not losing 10 points a turn.
Okay.
at a certain point, if you're trying to get all of the points, you're just, you know, like, you're casting your net too wide in order for it to be... to be efficient. You've got to be really focused, or at least this guy was really focused. And he would end the game turn 8 or 9 every single time. Like,
wow.
Because there are 7 huts in a stack, he would, like, maybe the first turn he wouldn't buy a hut, maybe, but probably he would be. And there might be one or two turns where he was not buying a hut. Just because someone was blocking him from his chosen stack.
Michael, you just trying it out for the first time out of a game where I think I scored just about 200 points. You had 170, I think, right? It was really close.
It was, yeah, I mean, it was way closer than it should have been. I think one of the other things about that strategy is that you do have to, every time you have the opportunity to, you have to go to the mating hut.
Right.
Because you're, you know, if you're getting through the game with only, you know, 5 or like 6 or 7 meeples, you're not going to be able to buy a hut every single round. And I didn't do that I didn't increase my population as much as I should have.
Yeah, because it doesn't hurt you any more to have 10 guys starving than it does to have 5 guys starving.
Right.
It's interesting that there's so many subtly different approaches in this game. What did I say a couple months ago, or, I mean, last week? I said Venetian diagram, and you guys didn't call me out on it, and we got done recording, and I was losing it laughing at how dumb that sounded, because I remembered, like, immediately.
I had already done some dick move of correcting you about something, or other. I didn't want to say anything.
It wasn't even a dick move. I was laughing when you did that the first time. Venetian diagram, that's pretty legendary in my own head, at least.
We're going to use it again for sure.
Well,
where the canals meet.
Oh man! So what's the what's the dissection final verdict on this game? I'm not done necessarily discussing it, but like as far as the value, if you can find it for $50, which I think is the MSRP, I am like 10 thumbs up for $50.
Yeah, the problem is that it's so rare, and I guess it's out of print. Or whatever, maybe it's still in print, but in Europe or something.
Yeah.
But it's really hard to find for under $80.
Yeah,
and combine that with the fact that it's available to play on both Board Game Arena and on Yukata.
And there's also a copy to play at our local board game store, so you know that matters to everyone.
If you live near Durham, North Carolina, come on by. Although why haven't you already? Our many tens of thousands of dedicated listeners, why aren't you swarming Atomic Empire in Durham, North Carolina?
It is a very good board game store. I mean, having been to a number of them around, it's pretty nice.
I wouldn't be shocked if any of our listeners anywhere in the U.S. have maybe ordered from AtomicEmpire.com already. It's a great online store. But so for $80, would you say? I mean, that's you're starting to maybe say questionable, right?
$80 is a big no for me.
It's got that leather dice cup.
It does have that leather dice cup. It's got gorgeous art. Everything is really fun. But $80 is two games that are not difficult to find.
Yeah.
I love this game, but I mean, if I had two recommendations for other games that did not require this. That sort of input. It's $49.99 at the Z-Man Games website right now, but it's out of stock.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so like full disclosure, we played this game at Atomic Empire, and I said, okay, this is what we're gonna play for our next dissection. Let me go get it, regardless of what the price is, because I had looked online and it was like $72 on Amazon, which was the only place I could find it. And I had waited a few days. Then we had played it at Atomic Empire, the three of us and Chuck. And I went home, and it was $84 on Amazon at that point. So I said, okay, screw it. I'm just getting it. I want our group to own this game because I'm a huge fan already. That was after one game. And I still haven't...
Sorry, Dave.
No. I'd like, as we said last time, right, I'm fine with it. I think, to me, this game is worth that much. The same way as last week's game, Role Player, $70. Sure. You know, I backed the Kickstarter for the Minions and Monsters expansion. Is that right? Minions and Monsters? Monsters and Minions, whatever it is. I backed it at over $100 because I want two copies of the base game and the expansion. So hit me up in March of 2018 when you can't find it and you want to pay me $101.
You got two copies of the base?
I want to make sure someone gets it. Like, that's how much I like that game. I want to make sure someone can buy it from me at a, like, all joking aside, at a reasonable price.
That's your first board game Kickstarter, right?
I've never felt comfortable paying for something that I don't know will be any good, right? I don't pre-order video games as an almost 100% rule, right? Like, the next Civilization, I'll go ahead and buy that if it's by Ed Beach, because I know he did Civ 5 Gods and Kings. I'm going to love whatever he does next. But in general, I just wait for reviews. I never go to see stuff on opening night, with a couple exceptions, you know, but like Kickstarter, it feels like the biggest dice roll.
Yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, it doesn't even necessarily, like, so Mike and I played Brewcrafters, which before it came out, and I backed the Kickstarter, and I loved that game the first time I played it, and I didn't have a problem backing the Kickstarter. It was an okay worker placement game once I had it and started playing it then later, but it was not as good as I remembered it.
Yeah, like, I mean, for me, I just... a lot of it is sometimes about support, you know?
Yeah, sure.
You got friends in the industry and you want to support them. Half of the other time is it's just I just don't have the time to devote to specific games.
Right.
Like I would like, and I just have a lot of games that are still in their wrapping.
Well, some games just require so much to get even one play out of them, right? Like, it's a huge ask to even get anywhere near your money's worth out of Twilight Imperium or something insane like that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you play it once, you've already paid for two movie tickets for a group of five people.
I mean, that is a good point. Yeah, because you just got an entire day or weekend worth of play out of something like that.
Right.
Yeah, but there's like the doctor's bills after spending that much time sitting down and playing it.
Like the bed sore you have.
That's why I like to play Twilight Imperium slightly hunched over and standing up.
in bed.
Well, for Stone Age, I would say, personally, pay whatever they want. Get your hands on a copy of this. But, like Michael mentioned, Board Game Arena or Yukata, you can play very serviceable versions of this game for free. I still don't understand how this works, how someone isn't going after these websites for the license, whatever, but they're there.
Yeah, but you know, if Yukata didn't have this and didn't remind me of how much I like this game, you wouldn't have bought this game.
Because of the chain of events leading to me wanting to buy it for you.
Right. There's a big difference between even just like playing a game live over Skype via one of these services and actually playing it in person. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways the licensing for things like Board Game Arena and Yukata and Tabletopia they're just like part of the advertising budget for some of these places.
I've attempted to play some games on Yukata that I have never played in person, and a couple of them I've managed to figure out, like the most simple games, but like worker placement games like Stone Age with the civilization cards, man, this is probably a tough game to figure out just through the online mechanism without really being able to sit down and go through it with like the components.
So it functions more as like a companion app to owning the game. Yeah,
exactly. Or just playing it with it, playing through it one time with someone who actually knows the game, who can show you exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Manipulating the pieces is a big deal when it comes to learning how a game flows, for me at least.
And another part of the component quality for this is that the little wooden pieces that represent wood and clay and stone and gold, they're not just blocks. There's like long thin logs for the wood.
They're brown.
And they're brown. And the gold is like ingot shaped yellow blocks.
It's yellow.
I just think it's so charming just to have that. The little meeples have got like little froze, so I like to take the yellow ones and pretend that I've got a tribe of like six Art Garfunkels helping me out.
Oh man. All right, well, since you didn't have to pay for it, Michael, value aside, do you like this game?
I like it enough to keep playing until I manage to beat Jeff.
I feel like I would never really have to win to enjoy the fact that I feel like I keep getting better. The skill ceiling seems to be almost infinite here, and the fact that I haven't really wrapped my hands, like my head around it, I want to keep playing it.
I want to play more 4-player games of this, because I feel like there's just something special about having that many people around this particular game.
It also, with 4-player games, you don't have any sort of limit to the number of people that can place on a space. So you can't have person A go one person on wood, person B go one little dude on wood, and then person C doesn't get any wood for the turn. You go up to the limit of 7 guys in any given spot, which changes the way that you've got to, that if you want to block someone, you really have to go in to block them.
Much more of a commitment, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay, the last thing I thought was interesting is that Jeff, you're going through this very specific experience with this game. It's a game that you love, that you wanted us to play with you, but we had no idea what to do with it. And so you're already pretty good at it, whether you knew it or not. You know, by comparison to us, you were like an adult around a bunch of toddlers. So I think everyone who's into games has had this experience where I want my friends and or loved ones or whatever to get into this thing that I love, but I am already so much better than they're going to be when they start. What do I do? Like, how do I get my friends to play Magic the Gathering when, like, the barrier to entry for them, money aside, is going to be, like, so many losses against me if we're going to be able to play with each other?
Well, Magic the Gathering, I mean, Wizards of the Coast has figured out how to do this by releasing these pretty unbalanced dual decks that are supposed to be balanced against each other, and you play with them once, you figure out, oh, this is the good deck, this is the bad deck, I'll play the bad deck because I know how to play the game,
right.
And that's its own balancing mechanism.
Well, not a great example, but like, Michael, we wanted to play Perfect Dark on N64 against Michael in high school. It was like... Again, he was like an adult just like with a Farsight XL, like just shooting shooting toddlers through 10 walls from across the map.
That's my favorite pastime. So, well, I think there's an onus on the person who's introducing the thing to not be like, not be a 14-year-old Michael about it, right?
Yeah, but so another problem with this game and many Euro games though is that you don't actually, you know, you don't know what the scores are going to end up being at the end of the game. Like, it's kind of surprising. The very first game that we played, Chuck was ahead of me by 40 points or something like that when the game ended, and then we were counting up the final score points, and I ended up, you know, Chuck ended up being in last place, and I ended up beating him by 80 points,
yeah,
or something like
right,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he had completely disregarded like the end game scoring, which is, as we've discovered, is a pretty important part of this game.
Yeah, he was also outside on the phone with his wife while I was explaining the
that's
game.
That's fair.
So.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. I remember in high school, I desperately wanted you guys to play Total Annihilation with me, and you were all sort of, you know, you were dabblers in real-time strategy, and that was my favorite one at the time, so of course I just played it.
I loved that game, and I hated playing it with you, because it would just be like I would finally get, like, this little strike force together to go out, and I'd be, like, scouting around the map with it, and then suddenly I would notice that my entire base was just, like, this glowing nuclear wasteland as I'm running into your tier 3 tank lines. But it was really a pretty way to get the strike. Was that game? I actually played Total Annihilation maybe about 6 months ago or something like that, and I still think it's a really pretty game.
It holds up.
Yeah.
I think that this is a thing that happens with lots of stuff, not just games, right? It's a, like, if you watch a TV show that you really like and you want to share with people, I mean, like, I've been trying to get Dave to watch Twin Peaks, and there's kind of like a barrier to entry with that. It's like, you know, 25-year-old show that you kind of have to go back to the beginning if you want to even understand what's going on.
Yeah. As nerds, I think we all sort of understand, like, it's difficult to learn the light touch required to, it, like, get someone into what you're into. You know, if someone says, okay, fine, I've never seen a Star Wars movie in my life, I'll go see a Star Wars movie with you. You can't spend the whole car ride, like, talking about the last novel that you read based in the Star Wars expanded universe, and, like, the entire time the trailer's going on, like, explaining who every single minor character that's going to be in Rogue One, like, and then hold, you know, get ready to see this guy, get ready to see this guy, right? Like, we have this tendency as nerds to get so into our hobbies that it can be hard to downshift to first gear to, like, have someone else come along with you.
Yeah, I actually kind of hate that part of it too, where you are kind of sitting beside them watching the thing that you love, and you're kind of that expectant, like, looking over, are they enjoying this as much as me, or oh, they're totally hating it, this is the worst idea ever,
yeah,
why did I even try,
are they getting it the same way that I am too, like, I want to catch you up on the, you know, the 20 years of fandom for whatever. And it's your first day, right? It's ridiculous of me to expect that, but I'm like, I want you to feel the same way about this that I did, you know, it's insane.
And then they shrug and they're like, it's not really my thing.
And then you're crushed.
How did you feel introducing this to us, Jeff? Like, did you, I mean, you said earlier that you didn't, maybe you didn't bring your 100% A game to the table, but how was it?
Well, it was great because you guys all liked it. And that's, you know, that's of course the thing that you want when you do bring something to some people. But I really wish that I had not won that first game. Like that was not my intent. Because
no, yeah, it was, you were trying to win.
No. I mean, I was trying to win, but I was not doing everything that I possibly could do.
Well,
I just,
why stop there? I wish you hadn't won all of the games.
No.
We can still play, Jeff, and you can still try not to win.
It's never too late.
The very first game, I was not going for, like, super scoring stuff, but there's just like an automatic like response of saying, oh, well, there's Tripsuts at for one wood. I'm definitely gonna pick that up.
It's so hard for Jeff not to.
Guys, no, like there's the way that you teach like, you know, a friend of yours how to play chess, where you go through and you let them have takebacks, and then there's the way that you teach your annoying little cousin how to play chess, which is you destroy them again and again and again.
And to be fair, all of your opponents in that first game, we were so blind to the true nature of scoring. Like, you would have had to take our turns for us to really fix the outcome of that game any other way than you winning. We just totally didn't get it. Like, I know Michael and I, for sure, we looked at that board and we said, build an engine. Ben, we were building that engine until you ended the game.
You just got to spin the board around like my dad used to do when he would play checkers with me. Okay, here you go. You can be me. You're in this great position.
Well,
I'm glad you introduced us to this game that you continue to destroy us at.
You know, I would love to know the best way to do this. And you know, David, I'm sure that you wish that you had not, like, you know, raffle stomped us at Total Annihilation as many times. Michael, I know that you took vast amounts of pleasure in Perfect Dark.
I feel like I made the right choice.
Yeah. Didn't we? I think we stopped allowing that weapon because it was just it was pointless, right?
Perfect Dark was great for having lots of modularity in the like the weapon setup and things like that.
Still, my favorite one that I remember to this day is Slayer Only, the remote control missile. Like, everyone would go to a point on the map that they thought was going to be unlikely for someone else to discover while flying their own remote control missile around. So no one had anything but this remote control missile, and your avatar in the game was motionless while you were piloting the missile around. So you had this moment sometimes where in a long hallway, both players who have their missile in flight would pass each other's missile as the missile. And then, you know, it's like, oh God, it's a race against time. I have to find his body before he finds my body.
Was that the game where we devised the if you punch someone in the game you get punched in real life?
I think so. That
was in GoldenEye, because I think in GoldenEye the blurry state from getting punched like lasted into your next life. Yeah. That was the problem.
Oh yeah, I remember. Yeah, you were blurry as you respawned. Yeah, like
yeah, which was the most unfun thing they possibly could have done. Like, you know, if you just get blurry until you're dead, well, whatever, that's one life. But man, you could punch someone seven times and they'd be blurry for like the next minute and a half.
You know they released the game on purpose in that state. You know it.
Of course the developers were doing it to each other and they thought it was hilarious.
Oh man. Well, good times, man. I'm really glad that I spilled beer on your Castles of Mad King Ludwig piece, because now we have Stone Age in the group.
And we still have Castles of Mad King Ludwig. That's the reason that it's great.
We have 2.98 copies of Castles. Well, 1.98. That joke would have been funnier if I'd gotten the math right. Yeah, and I'd be better at Stone Age if I got the math right.
Any excuse to buy a new game.
All right.
Yeah.
A new good game, which maybe is a good segue to what we're going to play next month.
Do we know?
I mean what? Next week.
Next week? I think we do know, right?
Yeah.
We're going to play a dozen games this week. All right.
I got a copy of Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, which is a game kind of unlike any other game that we've played for the show. So that's going
to
be interesting.
I'm looking forward to it. Like, the Internet's own Austin Walker is a huge fan of that game. And I think the Internet's own Patrick Klepek is also. Well, they both work at Vice's Waypoint outlet these days, but yeah, I think in the past they have both tweeted profusely about how much they enjoyed it. So
I have not delved into it because it is very much a, you know, a spoiler heavy game, but it should be interesting. It's a storytelling game, it's a puzzle game, it's a whole bunch of booklets inside of a box.
How are we going to play this like 10 times if it's got limited replayability? Are we going to get to replay other things this month? This week?
Find that out.
Ah, yeah. Excellent. I'm excited.
Well, it's not like Betrayal at the House on the Hill is unreplayable, even if you've had one scenario show up, right? Like, out of the 30 or 40 scenarios any particular edition of that game happens to ship with, maybe the one where the traitor suddenly is in control of, like, 50 bats and all the other players are trying to escape the mansion, maybe that one came up 20 plays ago. You don't remember exactly how it works. The traitor might be a different person. I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I don't know the first thing about how Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective actually plays.
I think that game is unreplayable just because there's a dozen games that does what it wants to do better.
Yeah, I think Betrayal at House on the Hill is unplayable just because it's a terrible game.
Okay, that's the purview of a much different episode. Okay, well, we're done, right? Let me just remind everybody that dissection.com will get you to our website, and a review and a rating on iTunes and a recommendation to your friend will help us out a great deal. Really, just get a friend who plays board games to listen to us. That's like the number one way that we will reach new people, is with your help.
Wait, actually, Dave, we did have some questions. Do we want to go through those?
Wait,
or...
did we really?
Wait. Yeah, so... Michael, you pulled some questions from BGG?
I did pull some questions from BGG.
Why didn't you warn me? Oh, my Lord.
Because I completely forgot. Muscle relaxers.
You know the show notes that we have for these, Dave?
No one ever sent me a link to those.
They're the same. It's the same document we've been...
I assumed there would be a new document for a new show. Little did I realize.
We're so lazy.
We're still figuring this whole thing out.
This is how the sausage is made, folks. Very poorly and without input from Dave.
Okay, so, I pulled some questions from BGG just that I thought were kind of interesting. And the first one, Mortego asks, what are some common mistakes the players make either with setup or playing the game of Stone Age? We always... forgot to feed. So I would definitely, I think we ended up just starting to feed our guys at the end of each player's turn instead of like all at once right before the beginning of the next turn.
Yes.
Right?
Because in general, by the, you know, at the end of your turn, you have figured out how you're going to feed your people or if you're not going to. That's the point where you remember. It's sort of tough to remember, oh, right before I pass over, you know, the big chief token to the next first player, we all have to go through and figure out you owe 7 food and you owe 3 food and you owe 5 food.
I think we had a couple of questions while we were playing about the fact that you can get, like, you can gain net food if you have an agriculture score that's greater than your population.
Right. The agriculture thing just gives you 1 food per agriculture each turn, so if you don't have to pay it, and you can save it up for the next turn, say, if you're going to be getting additional people.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I never got that high.
Well, you're that high right now. Hey-oh!
So the other thing, and I'm not trying to sell you down the river, Dave, but you had a bit of an issue with remembering which set of meeples were your villagers and which were the set of meeples that were separate for them.
Yes, I do.
So this is really tough to do if there are 4 players, but if there are 2 or 3 players... you can just stick all the extra guys around the love shack so that they're just sitting there in the middle of the board. You're not going to attempt to use them from your player board.
No, that was a revolutionary change for my experience playing the game. I really needed that help.
And there was another question I thought was interesting. It's less of a rules question, more of a maybe a rules as intended question. Chung Kim wrote... recently, I played in a tournament held by a local board game club, and I saw a player taking notes with pen and paper about the civilization cards that other players bought. He always knew exactly how many scores each player would end up with when the game ends. Later on, the referee banned him from taking such notes. He was quite discontent with the referee's decision. Chung is asking... what do you think about taking notes while you're playing this game? Is it unfair or bad behavior? And Jeff, what do you think?
So I think that the that
the ref was wrong. So the civilization cards are, they're intended to be taken face up. There is a way to get a face down civilization card. And that's supposed to be hidden information. But otherwise, you're supposed to be able to look around the table and see, oh, this person over here, they're starting to get a few tool makers, so maybe I need to either block them from getting tools or block them from getting any more tool maker cards. Tool makers being the multiplier card for tools at the end of the game. And I think that taking notes, if you're not taking too much time to do it, you shouldn't be. That's it's not against the rules, and it's not interfering with other people. So go ahead and do it. I mean, you're killing the fun of the game, and you're kind of being a dweeb, but you do you.
Is it fun to say the player who can juggle one or two or three more pieces of information, given how many players are in the game, that player has a like an advantage at the end of the game? Is it fun to say that? I mean, if it is, then ban people from writing that down. If not, like, whatever.
I mean, this game definitely would be less fun if there was an ongoing scoreboard that would tell you, including all multipliers that are all already known to the game. Like, a big part of the fun of this game is figuring out how many points you've got at the end of the game.
That's exactly why I think that this particular behavior is kind of abhorrent, and I would not want to play with someone who's doing this. First of all, because I think unless they were really good at it, I think it would require them to spend time to do it between turns, mm-hmm. and that would be obnoxious. But second of all, if you wanted to turn this into a sort of a like every player has the same advantage kind of thing, it is that scoreboard. It's the Carcassonne app where everybody knows what tiles are left, and that's fine as long as everybody has the same advantage, in my personal opinion.
Well, so first of all, this was during a tournament. So if you're going to do this terrible sort of behavior, you do it during a tournament, not when you're playing with your friends. And second of all, the Carcassonne app presumes foreknowledge of every single tile that's in the game, which isn't supplied somewhere that you should be able to see.
Well, it very specifically like replaces the need for foreknowledge, right? Like, they just decided that we're going to level this part of the playing field.
Yep.
Right.
I could see it either way, personally. I mean, sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
I just like Jeff. If you think the idea of a scoreboard that keeps tally as someone is playing, like, if, for instance, as you were playing this on BGA or on Yukata, if it just kept a tally of the public knowledge, mm-hmm. that would be lame, I think.
Oh, they don't do it, and they absolutely could do it. Yeah. And there's a reason that they don't do it.
Yeah.
You can figure it out for yourself if you want to. You can see every single card that should be available to see, but they don't do that tallying because that kills the fun. But, you know, again, in a tournament setting, you know, you don't have to do what's fun.
I could see it either way. Like, for one, I would not sit there and write it all down in a game with you guys and some beers around a kitchen table. But if I was in a tournament, I'd probably be the guy doing that, right? Especially if there were some prizes on the line. When I play Hearthstone, the arena mode, I for damn sure use a deck tracker because the Blizzard Entertainment has decided they're fine with any, third-party application, companion application that just replicates something you could write down with pen and paper. So if I had, like, 30 physical cards in front of me to represent my 30 random cards that I've drafted for a Hearthstone arena run, you know, I could be doing it in front of me, and Blizzard says they're fine with that. I do it every time because there's prizes on the line and I care about it. Does that make me, like, a tool bag? Sure, but I like winning that game enough that I'm going to do it. So
I don't think it makes you a tool bag. I think it is 100% situational, and I'm fine with that.
I mean, if one of you guys was doing it at our at our house game, I would mercilessly make fun of you to your face.
Yeah. All right.
Any more questions?
Yeah. Those are the only two I pulled.
Okay, yeah. Just give me some warning next time, so I don't do the awkward goodbye thing. I did that at work tonight too, where I'm like, I said goodbye to two different ladies who I thought were about to leave, and individually, two different moments, they both looked at me like I was crazy and said bye, and then I came around the corner as they were coming around a different corner, and they're both looking at me like, you're still here. Why'd you say goodnight? And I just had to say out loud, now I get it. Sorry. Because it was so stupid.
Yeah. I hate having to say goodbye more than once. It's just... So on that note, I'm just going to log off.
Well, all right. Then for Michael and for Jeff Maroknik, unless there is anything at all left to say, find it. I simply love you for that. That's an incredible dice cup, guys. It really is. All right. Find us at dissection.com. Look for us everywhere on the internet. We are Dice Section. All right, guys. See you next time.
This podcast has been a production of the Geek Dad Podcast Network. If you've enjoyed this content, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geekdad.
Give us one more roll for good measure.
One more. Oh, yeah. Oh. That's definitely a 42.